Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It's great to be back on the air with you guys. Hard to believe tomorrow is Thanksgiving for those of us living in the United States. But then again, I think it's fair to say that no matter where you live in the world, all of us celebrate Thanksgiving. And why not? We all need to be thankful for not only just one thing, we need to be thankful for various things that have gone well for us throughout various chapters in our lives. Hard to believe that this episode of Michael Schumacher's Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea, is our final episode of this book topic podcast series discussion. You know, I'm sure some of you have often wondered, has Kirk ever found a particular series that has been his favorite of all, or one that he's really enjoyed the most? I'd have to say every one of the podcast series discussions that I have done, regardless of book topic, they've all been unique. They've all had their own stories to tell. They've all been their own works of art. But if I had to pick one off the top of my head, it would probably be this one that I'm doing. Of course, my mind could change somewhere later on down the road, but I would have to say right now, this one has probably been my favorite. It's probably been my favorite because of the because of how powerful the story itself has been. It's powerful based on the fact that when only few people survive and so many die, we do have to wonder, why did those of us whom were in the minority, meaning the small number, survive, whereas the majority didn't? And is life still worth living? Well, in this final episode of Michael Schumacher's Torn in Two, we're going to learn about how Dennis Hale copes with it all. We're also going to find out whether or not he is alone, and if there were others before him who were in the same situation that he was in terms of fewer men surviving and more crewmen dying. We will also learn how Dennis Hale overcomes one of the most painful chapters in his life and how he turns it into something perhaps more positive, because out of darkness does come lightness. I think we all should be reminded of that. You know, it is also hard to believe that today represents the 60th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I know I wasn't alive in 1963, but every time I watch documentaries of that fateful day, I always have to put myself in the people's shoes whom were alive, not only during that time, but whom were in Dallas that day, watching the motorcade turn from Houston onto Elm Street and gradually making its way past the Stemmons Freeway and eventually to the Trademark building complex where President Kennedy was supposed to have made his speech. I can't imagine being a bystander, watching that motorcade go by, only to see the most horrific of scenes occur. It's one thing to hear in person that a fallen leader has died, but to have witnessed it in person, to me, is just, it's not something you ever get over. Maybe it takes time, but it doesn't happen overnight. I was too young to have remembered when this one happened, but I've seen documentaries on it when Ronald Reagan was nearly assassinated. His bodyguard, Secret Service agent Jerry Parr, the late Jerry Parr, he died 8 years ago at the age of 85. Jerry Parr was not supposed to have been assigned that day, but long story short, the other Secret Service agent who was either not feeling well or something else came up, so Jerry Parr filled in for this other fella. Jerry Parr was at the right place at the right time. The bullet that got Ronald Reagan was about an inch away from his heart. Once the limousine sped away from the hotel where Reagan had finished making his speech, the the plan was to go back to the White House. Well, Ronald Reagan admitted he was in pain, so Jerry Parr examined him again. I mean, Parr pushed him into the limousine very forcefully. He had to. And he did notice that the president was suffering bleeding. Well, they got him to the hospital, George Washington Hospital, or the GW Medical Center. Jerry Parr's quickness and instant reactions in terms of protecting the president's safety from a medical standpoint was insurmountable. Had Jerry Parr not made those decisions and quick thinking, split decision making when he did, had they gone to the White House instead, Ronald Reagan would have died, from internal bleeding. So, you know, my heart goes out to Clint Hill, whom was Jackie Kennedy's Secret Service agent. I can only imagine what he must have, what was going through his mind 18 years later when Ronald Reagan almost met the same fate. But as I said before, and I'd say it again, if there was one president that I did live under whom was the closest thing I got to a John F. Kennedy, it was Ronald Reagan. Well, I think it's time that we get the show on the road, as we have a lot to cover in this final episode of a segment of Michael Schumacher's Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. So here we go. Given Dennis Hale never sailed again after the SS Morrell sinking, what issues did he face going forward from a personal standpoint? For starters, he endured a series of post-traumatic stress disorder issues, or what's called PTSD, which resulted in severe difficulty behind recovering from an event such as the ship's sinking, in this case, where so many lives were lost. Well, think about it. So many lives were lost, folks. In this case, we're obviously with a crew of 29. We're talking 28 out of 29 men dying. And not only just that, but survivor's guilt, knowing that Dennis Hale himself was the lone survivor behind this shipwreck. Dennis Hale often said the following in the aftermath of the Morrell sinking. This is in quotation, folks. "I don't want to be Dennis Hale, the only survivor of a shipwreck. I just want to be Dennis Hale." Yes, Dennis Hale was a crew member of the SS Daniel J. Morrell, but he wanted the public to see him as someone whom was more than just an incident survivor. Hale himself wanted to live his life as best as possible without constantly getting reminded of a situation which left scars that never fully went away. Yes, there are always going to be people out there whom will say, "Oh, there's Dennis Hale," or "It wasn't that the fellow whom survived, whom was the lone survivor of the SS Daniel J. Morrell." Yes, there's nothing wrong with maybe referring to that, but at the same time, if I'm Dennis Hale, my response would be, "Hey, look, guys," or "Look, people. Yes, you can remember me as someone whom survived an ordeal that most people would never want to have to go through. But I'm like you all. I'm still an average Joe person. I can still live a regular life. But I want to be remembered more than just a guy whom survived a terrible ordeal that took place in the month of November, when nothing is ever certain, but I just want to be remembered as someone whom is still capable of living a normal life like you guys can, even in the midst of conflict, even in the midst of trials and tribulations that we all endure in life." Now, I'm going to bring up two fellows' names. You guys probably don't know of their names. However, for those of you who've been with me for some time, 2 years ago, I remember doing a podcast series on the wreck of the Carl D. Bradley. So for those of you who are new to my podcast series discussions, you all are going to find you all are going to obtain some relevant information that connects to what we've been talking about with Dennis Hale and his experience. So here we go with this question. Who are Elmer Fleming and Frank Mays? Both men are natives of Rogers City, Michigan, which is located well up in northeast Michigan, not too terribly far from the northern mainland, the furthest northern mainland post of Michigan that connects, that is connected to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan via the Mackinac Bridge. So Rogers City, Michigan, located in northeast Michigan, along Lake Huron. Both of these men are natives of Rogers City, Michigan, whom were on board the SS Carl D. Bradley, a 639-foot freighter, which perished in a Lake Michigan storm on November 18th of 1958, claiming the lives of 33 out of 35 crewmen. Okay, folks, Dennis Hale was the lone survivor out of 29 crewmen on board the SS Daniel J. Morrell. Frank Mays and Elmer Fleming are the only two survivors out of 35 crewmen on board the SS Carl D. Bradley. Hard to believe this past Saturday marked the 65th anniversary of the Bradley sinking. Why is the number 23 important? That is the total number of crewmen from the port town of Rogers City. 23 out of 35, folks. That's 66% of all the men whom died on board the vessel. The Bradley sinking was most likely due to structural failure from brittle steel used when built in 1927. Well, isn't it fair to say that the SS Daniel J. Morrell and her sister ship, the SS Edward Y. Townsend, were constructed using brittle steel that was built well before 1948, we should say that steel itself got a much needed upgrade. Yes, and what do you know? In 1948 and onward into the mid 1960s, the Bradley, even though she sank in 58, the Bradley was still out on the waters. She had a 31-year career, which was remarkable, but I think her sinking could have been prevented had better quality steel been used, given that 10 years earlier, a new line of steel had come out onto the market for ships, for newer ships to be constructed with. What was the most, before I give you all that question here, both Elmer Fleming and Frank Mays faced similar problems that Dennis Hale himself encountered. What was the most difficult of hardships faced by Carl D. Bradley survivors Elmer Fleming and Frank Mays? When I learned about this when reading about the wreck of the Carl D. Bradley, my heart went out to both of these men. I just couldn't believe what had happened, and I'm sure many of you whom have been with me for some time who were a part of the Bradley book topic series discussion felt the same way too. But for those of you whom are new to this, I want you all to be prepared because we all need to be reminded that even when we've overcome hardships, there have been instances throughout the course of history where those whom have survived a terrible ordeal have not always come home to a hero's welcome. And isn't it fair to say that here we are in 1966, in the aftermath of the sinking of the Morrell, that we have this war going on in Vietnam? People are starting to question whether or not it's even worth sending young boys or men out into the fields to die for something that the government thinks is worth fighting for, but the American public doesn't. And what I've had to learn over time is that many veterans who served in Vietnam, when they returned back home, many of them sadly did not get a hero's welcome. Many of those people were sadly frowned upon. It didn't make it right, but that's what happened. So as for the question of the following, what was the most difficult of hardships faced by Carl D. Bradley survivors Elmer Fleming and Frank Mays? How about this? Both men were heavily frowned upon by townspeople in Rogers City, Michigan. This is a town, folks, that I don't know where the population stands today. It could stand between 2,000 and 3,000 people. But in the late 1950s, the town population was just shy of 4,000. And it is a port town, one of the big jobs is working in the shipping industry. And I know that there's a port called the Port of Calcite in Rogers City, which is known for transporting limestone in and around the Great Lakes per various port destinations. And that was the case back in 1958 with the SS Carl D. Bradley. Her home was Rogers City, but sadly she sunk along Lake Michigan's waters in November of 58. So sadly for Elmer Fleming and Frank Mays, they were frowned upon. They were heavily frowned upon by the townspeople in Rogers City, Michigan, where they each resided. But yet so many deceased sailors' families still called it their home. Yes, Rogers City, small town located along Lake Huron. The locals, natives, demonstrated more hostility versus having compassion for Elmer Fleming and Frank Mays, whom survived an ordeal that they never expected to survive, but yet they knew that they were spared, but yet they didn't ask 33 of their own comrades, crewmates, to die. So we're left to wonder, why are we being spared, the two of us, but why did so many have to perish? Maybe it would have been just better off if the two of us died with our fellow crewmates. Elmer Fleming, the Bradley's first mate, was deeply saddened over the loss of so many fellow crewmates. He eventually went back out onto the waters, even as he received a captain's title for his own boat. However, it's one thing to be back out on the water, but I think no matter what your position is, I think dealing with rough weather and knowing what you experienced before, it does throw you for a set of curveballs and some unpleasant setbacks to where, in the case for Elmer Fleming, the rough weather forced him to resign from his post. Sadly, Elmer Fleming, folks, died in 1969, just 11 years after the Bradley sank, at age 54, wondering why so many had died and yet so few survived. You have to wonder if Elmer Fleming died of a broken heart, knowing that so many of his own fellow comrades died. And perhaps he could have died of a broken heart, knowing that so many in the Rogers City community didn't demonstrate enough compassion towards him, knowing that, you know, he didn't ask for this to happen, but yet he was shunned by so many from within. Frank Mays, on the other hand, never went back onto the waters. He only had a small number of friends drop by to visit him shortly after returning home from the hospital. Mays had said the following in quotations, folks. Had I done something wrong by surviving? Okay, how would you interpret this, Kirk? Well, here's how I interpret it, folks. For one, Frank Mays never asked for Rogers City's people to endure something so traumatic such as losing 23 of her own crewmen from the SS Carl D. Bradley. But yet he knew that God was watching over everyone on board the freighter. God doesn't play favorites. We should know that. God doesn't play favorites. God is looking after all of us, even in the most trying of circumstances that we have no control over. Of course, you know, we have to forward 17 years later when the Edmund Fitzgerald sank in 1975. followed by a year later in 76 when the late Gordon Lightfoot's song The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald came out, to hear a verse that's the following: "Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours?" In other words, yes, even when the waves are turning the minutes into hours, God is still looking after your safety. God is still hoping that the crewmen on board these ships, such as the Bradley, the Fitzgerald, even the Morrell, that they all could try to find ways to modify their situation, even under the most trying of circumstances. God doesn't wish any of this harm, but yet it happened. But we can't blame God. So, people's emotions within the town were so riled up, given nothing like this took place before on such a large scale, to where the end result got the better of the community internally. And I think it's fair to say that, yes, people's emotions do get riled up quickly. People rush to judgment. And, you know, it's so easy to think that the world we live in today is so volatile, and yes, it is, where people do rush to judgment, and in some instances have all the electronic devices that can post breaking news alerts. We can do just about anything we want, and that to me is scary. Not to get from a legal standpoint, but when we start doing stuff like that, then we have to ask ourselves, are we getting our facts straight before rushing to judgment? That's a whole other topic for another discussion on something else. But the bottom line is that even in 1958 and in 1966, we saw instances where communities did rush to judgment. Now, we will find out here soon whether or not Dennis Hale came from a town we'll find out here soon as to whether or not the town that Dennis Hale lived in was similar to Rogers City in terms of losing the same number of people. But regardless of how many people were lost, it still doesn't make it right that Frank Mays and Elmer Fleming got frowned upon. But there is some unique news, or I should say information, to know about Frank Mays. For one, in 2021, just 2 years ago, folks, and 1 year after the COVID pandemic, global pandemic took place, Frank Mays died at age 89. He lived long enough to participate in two underwater expeditions down to the wreck site of the SS Carl D. Bradley. He was fortunate enough, folks, that he was able to place a plaque on the wreck site in remembrance to those 33 crewmen whom perished. And he probably also did it also for Elmer Fleming, whom survived. But he did it for all of those men whom lost their lives. He also saw 40 years later in 1997 that the Bradley herself did split in two pieces, as he recalled seeing her breaking apart 40 years earlier in 1958 when she did split in two. So Frank Mays' recollections had not changed. We would certainly have hoped in all those years that passed since the initial incident that you would hope that maybe 10 or 11 families out of the 23 whom lost loved ones did over time forgive Frank Mays, and hopefully there were some who did forgive Elmer Fleming for how they rushed to judgment. I honestly don't know, but if you asked me real quick, it's easier said than done, but how would you have responded to a situation like this if you knew of families who lost their loved ones, lost their husbands or an uncle on, say, the wreck of the SS Daniel J. Morrell or the Carl D. Bradley? How would I have responded? Well, I would have said to my wife, I would have said, look, we can try to put ourselves in their shoes. But at the same time, we should not rush to judgment. We don't know what, say, Frank Mays and Elmer Fleming, or in the case of Dennis Hale with Daniel J. Morrell, we don't know what they've been through, but we do need to treat them like they would want to be treated. We need to give them the full satisfaction. We need to give them the full benefit of the doubt that they too are human, that they did not ask for this to happen. We need to show them kindness. We need to be there for them. Because when they come back into town, yes, there are going to be those who may not show the same level of kindness, but we could at least still be their friends because they didn't ask for this to happen. That's just my take on it. Of course, I know it's easier said than done, but if I had to be in the average Joe's shoes, whether it was in Rogers City or in Ashtabula, that's how I would have to approach it. Did Ashtabula, Ohio, see a large number of SS Morrell crewmen perish just like Rogers City, Michigan endured? No, folks, the actual opposite happened. Only two men from Ashtabula, Ohio, perished, being Arthur Fargo and Saverio Grippi, Hale's dear friend, or Dennis Hale's dear friend. Dennis Hale did visit with Mrs. Grippi, but the visitation, sadly, folks, did not go well. And I can't imagine being in Dennis Hale's shoes right here. He's trying to comfort a widower. Well, an extended family relative told Dennis it would simply no longer be best for him to come back. Well, I can't imagine having to swallow that pill right there. I'd almost want to say, how dare you tell me this? You don't know what I've been through. I've been through hell. I didn't ask to be the only survivor. I went above and beyond to try to save three crewmen on board a life raft. If Mrs. Grippi's husband had been on board that life raft, I would have done everything there was to have saved him. But you have to wonder, would it have been enough for the relative? There again, folks, it's all about being caught up in the moment with the emotions. Emotions all riled up. So, whenever Dennis Hale went out in public, people recognized to staring at him. Okay, it's one thing to stare at someone, but it would be a little uncomfortable. Okay, you're staring at me. What are you getting out of this? What do you want? What point are you trying to make? Okay, yes, I survived. What do you want to say? Dennis Hale viewed this as a loss of privacy. He found himself often having to change the subject right away when others brought up the Morrell sinking incident. It was just something he could not talk about. Yes, his friends may have had good intentions, but sometimes even friends have to be reminded that, you know, we can't always say everything that's on our mind right away, even if it's meant to comfort a friend whom went through something so horrific or something so unimaginable that, you know, the rest of us simply just can't comprehend. So, for Dennis Hale, believe it or not, folks, he became very fearful of storms. And I can understand why, given that he experienced a terrible storm, and not just so much in the month of November, but a storm that caused the vessel to split in two and take the lives of so many, and yet he spared. So for Dennis Hale, he became so fearful of storms to where he would take the family into the basement when the weather got tense, very bad. Even if it didn't result in anything catastrophic, that's how fearful he became. It's almost like now he's got a phobia, a fear of storms. Despite never returning back to working along Great Lakes waters, what did Dennis Hale partake in advocating during the 1970s? Well, he served as a lead advocate for safety awareness within the shipping industry, but was unable to see major reforms get passed. So you could, in some ways, you could almost see him as probably having been a lobbyist for an organization that advocated stricter safety standards, modified safety standards, So it could be, it's probably fair to say that he could have been a lobbyist for an organization on in going to Congress to get legislators to enact better shipping safety reforms. He did send reform requests as high up to the White House during President Jimmy Carter's administration. Hard to believe his wife died just a couple of days ago at the age of 96. And I think it's amazing that Jimmy Carter is 99 years old and he's lived as long as he has, even under hospice. To think he and Rosalynn Carter were married for 77 years, that's something very unheard of, but it was remarkable, a remarkable love story, perhaps, to say the least. Although Dennis Hale did send reform requests as high up to the White House during President Carter's administration, he never got much of a response back. The only thing I can think of as to maybe why he didn't get much of a response back, and this is going to sound crazy, but it is probably very true. Back at the start of November in 1979, 52 Americans in the embassy in Tehran, Iran, were taken hostage by extreme radical Islamic fundamentalists, whom were inspired by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, whom had just returned from being in exile in France. Earlier that year in 1979, the Islamic fundamentalists oversaw the ouster of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. So long story short of it is that 52 Americans were held hostage for 444 days. And I think it's fair to say that Jimmy Carter's presidency, from the time that the hostage crisis began up until the day he left office, it consumed his presidency to the point where any reform requests with regards to shipping industry matters simply just were not able to be looked at. That's my hunch or theory. We go to 1981, 15 years after the SS Morrell sinking. Dennis Hale was offered to attend and speak at Lake Superior State College in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, up in the Upper Peninsula. Hale was to be the guest of honor, given Larry Copeland filmed a documentary on the Morrell, on the SS Daniel J. Morrell, and intended to present it at the college. Dennis Hale agreed to attend, but he was very hesitant to speak at the event, given he hadn't spoken openly about the Morrell sinking since getting rescued by the Coast Guard 15 years earlier. His memories are still painful. And I don't blame him for having painful memories still. You know, it does take time to erase the memories, especially with something like this, knowing that you're the only one who survived. And I know that it obviously took a long time for Elmer Fleming and Frank Mays to try to go on with their lives as best as they could. But when you're the only survivor out of 29, there is a lot of survivor's guilt. Even for Frank Mays and Elmer Fleming being 2 out of 35, it's very painstaking, to say the least, if that's the best way to describe it from a 101 standpoint. But we have to wonder, can something change for the better here for Dennis Hale, given this moment that lies forward for him? So would Dennis Hale have a chance, or should I say, would Dennis Hale have a change of heart once arriving onto Lake Superior State's college campus? Yes, his mind changed for the better. How so? Well, he saw the school's displays of shipwreck memorabilia on site. So the school actually had displays of shipwreck memorabilia. I know that may not sound like the most attractive of stuff, but the memorabilia regarding the shipwreck tells a story unto itself. It tells a story, yes, of how this ship sank and what caused her to sink, but it also talks about a story of survival. It talks about how a man went above and beyond to try to save those three other men on board the life raft with him. It talks about how what he did, knowing that he was the only one left on board the life raft, and how he went above and beyond to do what was necessary to ultimately go about saving his life, which in the end it happened. So, yes, you have displays of shipwreck memorabilia on site, along with learning about banquet event getting dedicated to the entire crew of the SS Daniel J. Morrell. Once Dennis Hale learned of all this, he decided to go forward and speak before a larger audience. While sharing the story of survival with the greater audience, Dennis Hale got teary-eyed in intervals or in stages, and if I was in his shoes, I would too. He did manage to keep his composure together to where perhaps he felt somewhat liberated. When you are liberated, you have something taken off your chest. It's like the saying, I got the monkey off my back. There was something, something could be hanging over you for so long that no matter what you do or no matter how hard you try to avoid something, that obstacle never goes away. But over time, if you set your mind to it, there are things that can be modified. But Dennis Hale speaking at Lake Superior State College was the best gift that could have happened for him, in the sense that he felt liberated. How so? Because the listeners in the crowd were eager to hear about his epic battles for survival in the midst of battling November's fury versus rushing to judgment like what he encountered in the town of Ashtabula, Ohio. Now, yes, the widower, being that of Mrs. Grippi, her extended family relative was the one that had told Dennis it would be best not to come back. Now, yes, there were those in the community that, stared at him or just knew deep down, yeah, that's the guy who survived, the lone survivor. But still, for Dennis Hale, it's the following. I want to be more than just the guy whom survived the wreck of the SS Daniel J. Morrell, and that's what he was doing at Lake Superior State College. He's talking about an epic battle for survival, and not just a battle of survival in the midst of November's fury, but how he has been able to go forward 15-some years later and telling an audience that is willing to listen versus rushing to judgment. Dennis Hale's presence at Lake Superior State College was more than just his coming forward and telling his own story of survival. His story was also meant to honor the 28 deceased Morrell crewmen by making sure their presence on board the freighter vessel wasn't totally forgotten. Yes, those 28 men would have wanted him to have gone on with his life, lived it to the fullest. Yes, they would have wanted Dennis Hale to have kept their spirits alive. And don't think for one second that Mrs. Grippi's husband would have wanted that too. So for Dennis Hale to not only tell his own story of survival, which is paramount, but to keep the lives of those whom died, their lives were not to be forgotten. Their legacies weren't. For Frank Mays to have, with the Carl D. Bradley, to have done what he did in participating in those dive expeditions, to lay a wreath in remembrance of the 33 men whom died. He was letting his fellow comrades know that, yes, while yes, you all may have died, and yes, you all have been deceased since 1958, I haven't forgotten about you all. I will constantly do everything there is to keep your all's legacies alive. It's like being in the military. you do favors, you go behind the lines to risk your own life so that others above and below you could live in freedom. After presenting the story of survival to Lake Superior State College, Dennis Hale continued going forward and sharing his story more frequently with less fear, less worries as time progressed. He attended Great Lakes Maritime Conventions and memorials for ships whom sunk from the SS Carl D. Bradley to the SS Edmund Fitzgerald. Dennis Hale went as far as doing interviews with newspapers and magazine reporters to appearing in a cable television documentary focused upon the Edmund Fitzgerald. He presented his story, folks, to where books about his survival were released in 1996 and 2010. I think it's fair to say that my fascination with Great Lakes shipwrecks came about 9 years ago when I first listened to Gordon Lightfoot's The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I may have mentioned that either from when we talked about the Edmund Fitzgerald 3 years ago, or perhaps from another Great Lakes documentary that I've done. But that was the first time I had learned about the Edmund Fitzgerald, and I was, you know, very curious to know going forward after listening to the song, you know, what made that ship so unique. And I started learning all the information there was. Then there was the Bradley. And then I went forward with that, and the same with November's Fury about the 1913 storm. So these shipwrecks on the Great Lakes have stories of their own to tell. Because as I've said before, and I'd say again, you know, whenever we think of shipwrecks, we often think about the Lusitania, the Titanic. Not that those shipwrecks aren't important, they are, but that's usually what we think of. But we do forget of other shipwrecks that were significant for their time. But it's just easy to forget that to forget the other incidents. Did Dennis Hale eventually conquer his phobias or fears about going back into the water? There is good news to report, folks, that he did. It did take time. Come 1999, hard to believe that's almost been a quarter of a century, 1999. After 33 years since the Morrell sinking, Dennis Hale spent time on board SS Roger Blau, an 835-foot bulk carrier whom assisted, believe it or not, folks, in the search for the SS Edmund Fitzgerald. She even was responsible for recovering a 25-person life raft from the Fitzgerald one day after she sank. The Fitzgerald sank on November 10th of 1975, but this life raft was found by the SS Roger Blau on November 11th of 1975. So Dennis Hale, he's gone on board the Roger Blau. She's going from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan to Two Harbors, Minnesota for a load of taconite. While on board the Roger Blau, Dennis Hale spent time in the pilot house in the engine room, along with learning everything possible about the Blau per those whom worked on board her. Being on board the Roger Blau reminded Dennis Hale of all the camaraderie that he experienced being on board the SS Daniel J. Morrell. The camaraderie itself was not just so much about people working together in terms of crewmates one-on-one, but it was really more about a family. A sense of family that brought Dennis Hale joy. Not just 101 joy, but joy that perhaps went above 101. From the days of yesteryear, from the days past. You know, I'm sure some of you are probably wondering real quick, you know, Kirk, if you had the chance to work on a Great Lakes freighter vessel, what would your position have been? What would you have wanted to have done? This is going to sound crazy, folks, but if I had to work on a Great Lakes freighter vessel, I would have been a cook. Why a cook? Well, I enjoy cooking. I really do. My side job is working at a restaurant, and I've really enjoy not only prepping food, but cooking food and doing whatever else is required in the restaurant, because there's never a dull moment. So I would not have minded whatsoever having been a cook on board a freighter vessel. But of course, I would have had to remind myself that you are cooking for more than just yourself. You are cooking for, say, 30 other crewmen. So you better make sure that whatever it is you're cooking, the crewmen are going to appreciate, because you want to make sure you get it right. You want to make sure that not only you get it right the first time, but that they're going to keep coming back for more stuff down the road. So, what happened on September 2nd of 2015? Hard to believe this has been 8 years ago. Sadly, Dennis Hale passed away from cancer at age 75. He died just shy of 50 years since the SS Morrell had sunk to the bottom of Lake Huron. He died at the home of his daughter, whom lived in Ashtabula, Ohio, where nearly 50 years earlier his return home was one of mixed emotions from within the community. But knowing nearly 50 years later, he was in a better place within the community. It also just so happens, folks, that Dennis Hale was not only a U.S. Army veteran, but he was a founder of the Ashtabula Lighthouse Restoration and Preservation Society. So what do you know, folks? He not only survived a terrible shipwreck, knowing that he was the only survivor out of 29, but I think it's fair to say that he left Ashtabula very proud. And by being a founder of the Ashtabula Lighthouse Restoration and Preservation Society, I know that his friend Saverio Grippi, whom died on the Morrell, would have been in awe of what Dennis had done. And don't think for one second, had Saverio survived, that he too would have perhaps been a founder of the Ashtabula Lighthouse Restoration and Preservation Society. Well, our last question, folks, is the following. I mentioned something about some stuff about Daniel J. Morrell, for whom the ship was named after, in a much, much earlier podcast segment episode for this topic series, but I figured it'd be best to go ahead and tell you all this one now. Did Mr. Daniel J. Morrell live long enough to see the vessel bearing his name get launched onto Great Lakes waters in August of 1906? No, he died, folks, in August of 1885 at age 64. It just so happens that Daniel J. Morrell was a member of the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, the site of Johnstown, Pennsylvania's South Fork Dam that formed Lake Conemaugh. Daniel J. Morrell pleaded with safety officials to strengthen the dam's structural integrity. He went as far as even having to warn fellow men like Andrew Carnegie of the dangers that lied ahead with this dam if nothing was done to better fortify it. Nobody listened to Daniel J. Morrell. He went as far, folks, as saying to the people, "Look, I'll finance with my money a better dam. I'll oversee it. You guys won't have to pay a dime, but I will finance this." They didn't want Mr. Morrell's money. Well, 4 years after Daniel J. Morrell passed away, folks, the warning still went unnoticed, and in 1889, the Great Johnstown Flood occurred, resulting in the deaths of 2,200 people. Yes, 28 men died on board the SS Daniel J. Morrell because of brittle steel. 2,200 people died in Johnstown, Pennsylvania because officials were too naive to think that nothing would happen, that this dam would not break apart, and yet it did. At the time of the incident, folks, it cost $17 million. Today's time, about $450 million. Well, That covers it all, folks. We have finished another book topic podcast series. Thank you for being such great listeners. I don't know where we're going to go next. Something tells me that I do know where we probably will go next, but I have to do my homework to ensure that where we go next is the right course to go, because it's one thing to be on the air, but if you're going to be on the air with a topic that you know you can do, you better stick with it, because there's no going backwards. I will try to get back on the air again soon. It could be a little while, but that's okay. Well, thank you again for your time. Thank you again for being such ardent listeners. And no matter where you all live, continue to stay safe. And for those of you who live in the United States or elsewhere in the world, be thankful for what we have, because there are always others out there less fortunate than us. Take care.